You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, doctors often tailor treatments based in part on the race of the patient. One expert tells us that can sometimes steer treatment in the wrong direction. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. One of the biggest stories this week was the back and forth between Attorney General Brad Schimel and the Wisconsin Elections and Ethics Commissions. It all centers on a report Schimel released last week regarding the leak of documents from the John Doe investigation. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He's with us to break down this and other top Wisconsin news from the past week. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
Well, the latest development in this John Doe investigation leak story, now we have legislative leaders, Republican leaders, calling for the resignations of the heads of these two commissions, the Elections Commission and the Ethics Commission. What's going on?
Yeah, and I think you could even say it's gone a step farther than that, because you had today Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald say, really, resign, because if you don't, we're going to take up your confirmation before the state Senate, and we'll just see where that goes. You know, if the state Senate were to vote them down, that would kind of force the issue.
So quit or we're going to fire you.
It's the implied message there coming from Senator Fitzgerald, because right now the leaders of the Ethics and Elections Commissions are not saying they're going to step down. They have the support of their boards, which are made up of Democratic and Republican appointees. And I mean, this all goes back to when these people worked for the now defunct Government Accountability Board. That was disbanded. It split off into the Elections and Ethics Commissions that we have now, where they're working. But it was the Government Accountability Board that was involved in this John Doe 2 investigation into Governor Scott Walker's campaign. And that was looking at whether Walker improperly coordinated with conservative groups, especially during the recall. Schimel's report, specifically that investigation, is looking into how information from John Doe 2 was leaked to the Guardian newspaper and who did that. His report did not recommend any criminal charges. It did not point the finger and say, you did it to, you know, any one name, but it was very critical of the Government Accountability Board for not keeping better track of the records and preserving the secrecy that's supposed to go along with a John Doe investigation.
And criticism apparently of the newer Elections Commission and Ethics Commission, right, for how they protect their documents?
I mean, I think it ties, my understanding is it ties back to the administrators who now work there, worked for the GAB.
They were there
with
the GAB.
They were tarnished in the minds of Republican legislative leaders just by having been involved with the GAB when it was involved in the John Doe 2. But again, those administrators have the faith, at least at this point, they have the faith of their boards. That's who they answer to. Unless the full state Senate gets involved, like Fitzgerald is hinting it might.
Now, Republicans had accused the Government Accountability Board of partisan behavior, in part because of the John Doe 2 investigation, mainly. That's why the GAB is gone. That's why these two new commissions are put in place. But now they're saying that stain of partisanship, according to Republican leaders, is still there on these new boards that they created to replace the old board.
Yeah, I mean, the changes that we've gone through since that John Doe 2 investigation are pretty huge. So the investigation itself was shut down by the state Supreme Court, who said, yes, these groups, these third-party groups and candidates can coordinate. The legislature passed a law basically codifying that, going a little further, saying, yes, this is okay. The legislature disbanded the Government Accountability Board and split it up into these two new commissions. And the legislature said, by the way, in the future, John Doe's can't be used for this type of investigation. So it's a new world that we're in here today. All of that is kind of a distant memory, but some of the same people who worked for that GAB now work in these ethics and elections commissions, and that is who Republican leaders are going after right now.
And Democrats, I've seen at least some outside groups who support Democrats saying, wait a minute, this isn't you're punishing them for partisan misbehavior. You're punishing them, they're saying, for investigating you.
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats who are coming out and commenting on this today are saying, you know, Republicans, you are the ones being partisan here, that that the administrators for these agencies are doing their jobs and you're just trying to push them out of the way for your own benefit.
Stay tuned on this one. We're talking to Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, about the big news in Wisconsin politics. A report came out yesterday. This is at Politico, the national news website. They're saying Paul Ryan is talking to people, lots of people in his circle, about not wanting to stick around in this job, the thankless job of House Speaker, for too much longer.
Right. And pretty soon after that came out, Paul Ryan's office was saying, you know, no, there's nothing to it. Governor Walker was saying, no, I talked with Paul Ryan. He's not going anywhere. A lot of Republicans pushed back immediately and said, no, ignore this. It's not happening. But I think you got to look at that report from Politico. And this is not, I mean, this is not something that they took lightly. This is something that was reported out by two reporters at Politico who are pretty plugged in. You know, one of them, Tim Alberta, I know, covered Republican politics for the National Review very recently, a conservative publication. He has very good sources within the world of Paul Ryan, and they based their report on 3 dozen people who they said they had recent interviews with, 3 dozen people who know the speaker, fellow lawmakers, congressional and administrative aides, conservative intellectuals, and Republican lobbyists. And they said not a single person believed Ryan will stay in Congress past 2018. Ryan says, you know, asked if he's going anywhere. Ryan says no. Okay. But that is the basis of their reporting. They talked to a lot of people for this.
It'll be interesting to see how other Republicans in the House respond to that, because A, they would need somebody else to run in his district. B, they need some, it took some doing, it seemed like, to get Paul Ryan to take this job. It's a thankless job in a lot of ways. Like I said, when John Boehner left, they were really searching for a replacement. Now they'd have to replace Paul Ryan.
Yeah. And
if this happened.
Right. I mean, there was some question before Paul Ryan took this job over who could kind of unite the warring factions of the Republican caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives. Paul Ryan has been that guy so far. But if he were to leave, you know, what would happen? And remember, they have a lot that they want to do or maybe need to do in the coming year. And Politico spelled that out. So you've got they have to fund the government, raise the debt ceiling, modify spending caps, address the continuation of health subsidies, a long list of stuff that's going to be a heavy lift for whoever is that speaker. And if the members of the House of Representatives think Paul Ryan is on his way out, he can't really instill fear to kind of get stuff passed. You know, they're not going to be worried about crossing him, and it makes his job all the more difficult.
In other related political news, we had this special election in Alabama. A Democrat won in a very Republican state, a lot of special circumstances there. I think people in states all over the country are saying, okay, does this mean something? Is this part of a wave? Democrats are looking at that, at what happened in Virginia, where they won the governor's race, made big strides in the state legislature, some other special elections. They're making the case that this is that 2018 is their maybe wave year.
Yeah, I got to imagine that the conversations that you heard in Wisconsin following this and kind of the reaction to what happened in Alabama is repeating itself in states all over the country, with Democrats saying, hey, in our state, we're coming for you next, Republicans, and Republicans saying, look, the Alabama thing was a very special case because, of course, Roy Moore was a candidate with a lot of flaws. I mean, there were these reports that came out pretty close to the election of, you know, woman after woman coming out and saying Roy Moore made sexual advances when they were teenagers and he was in his 30s. Okay. This was, you know, you had a lot of Republicans out there saying, I believe this story. This is credible. Roy Moore needs to step down. So there is that special factor to this Alabama election. And that does kind of raise the question of whether or not you can look at that and, you know, find a trend in states like Wisconsin. But you do have special elections so far have gone Democrats' way, and Republicans control all of Congress and the White House. Typically when that happens in a midterm election, the other party benefits.
Want to listen to Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. He was one who had believed Roy Moore's accusers. He's asked by reporters here in the Capitol about lessons of the Alabama election.
What message did the election send last night?
The Alabamas didn't want somebody who dated 14-year-old girls.
I mean, is this a lesson for Steve Bannon?
I hope he pays attention that you need good candidates to win Senate races, yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of along the lines of this was an Alabama problem. This was a candidate problem. This is not a Democrat advantage problem.
Yeah, but you did hear a question there. If there was a message for Steve Bannon, the former political advisor to President Trump, who is now taking it upon himself to find kind of challenger Republicans who will shake up the so-called GOP establishment, maybe oust the Senate Majority Leader. Bannon backed Roy Moore in a big way. And at the end, President Trump backed Roy Moore in a big way. So it is definitely a loss for them. Their preferred candidate lost. And given President Trump's approval rating, you know, it's not like this is in any way a good thing for Steve Bannon or Donald Trump.
So a lot of time till the elections, though. Sean, thanks as always for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. He joined us to look back at the big Wisconsin news from the past week. Most scientists would tell you that race is a social construct with little or no biological meaning. But if it is, why is modern medicine still taking it into account? Patients often have to check a box that indicates their race when they see a doctor. People who defend that practice say it can give doctors important clues on their patients and play a role in diagnosis and treatment of at least certain conditions. Critics say it sometimes leads to mistakes, bad assumptions, and ultimately worse medical care. Lundy Braun is a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine and Africana studies at Brown University. She studies and has written on the history of medicine. Lundy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with the reasons for a doctor paying attention to their patient's race, looking for, I guess, certain conditions that might go along with a certain heritage. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think that one of the reasons that physicians look to race so immediately are actually due to the long history of racism in medicine. So medicine actually has been a site for the working out of racial hierarchies in the U.S., as historians of medicine have shown. So we're enmeshed in that that history, and it hasn't been ever been fully refuted, although it's been critiqued, of course. I think the, you know, another reason for, I think, perhaps a heightened attention to race in the clinic comes from the NIH, an NIH mandate in the 1990s to include race in clinical research. This had a laudable effect of documenting health disparities and racial disparities in particular. But what it's also led to is a proliferation of documentation without adequate explanation that then kind of morphed into genetic studies to explain racial difference. So I think, you know, how we got here is a complicated socio-historical phenomenon. I think many physicians are well-intentioned and have been taught, actually, that this will help clinical practice. So on the other hand, most physicians, there's been, you know, a fair number of studies showing that most physicians actually do think race is a biological construct. So some of the division between, and I, you know, again, I think it's much more complicated, but some of the division is among social scientists as opposed to biological scientists and physicians in terms of what actually is race.
I want to get into a couple of particular diagnoses, conditions that enter into this question and that are more complicated than I thought reading up on this. Sickle cell anemia, usually associated, it's a genetically caused condition, usually associated with people from Africa, here in the United States with African Americans, to where a doctor, if they're dealing with a black patient, might think sickle cell is a possibility. A white patient think it's not at all a possibility. Turns out that's wrong both ways.
Right. And I just have to mention the work of Keith Wailu, who studied sickle cell anemia, and particularly the historical moment in which it was identified in the U.S., So it is true that at that moment, it was, I think it was 1910, and then it became a black disease in the popular and scientific imagination. What's quite interesting is that actually the sickle cell is the mutations in the beta hemoglobin gene are distributed much more widely than in Africa, and in many parts of Africa, sickle cell is not present. So, for example, South Africa has a very low prevalence of sickle cell. India has certain areas in India have a high prevalence. Greece has a high prevalence. So, it does have a higher prevalence in African Americans in the U.S., but it's not a black disease in any way, shape, or form. And it's, I think many states now do newborn screening for sickle cell in general because of all the cases that could be mixed. Yet it's had a tremendous stigmatizing effect on African Americans.
Talking to Lundy Braun from Brown University about the use of race in medical diagnosis. Another condition that you mentioned health disparities earlier is more prevalent among African Americans: hypertension, high blood pressure. But does that mean it's a genetic thing? Is this a racial or heritage-based thing, or does it have a social cause? Can you talk about that issue?
Yeah, so that's a really important question because hypertension is so widespread in the U.S. population, regardless of race. But it is of the prevalence of hypertension, and importantly, the severity of hypertension in the U.S. is more common among African Americans. Yet, Richard Cooper did a very nice international study, I think in 2005, if I'm correct. And what he showed is that actually Germany and Finland had the highest rates of hypertension in the world. And with U.S. blacks, you know, sort of intermediate, still higher than U.S. whites, but Nigerians had the lowest rates of hypertension. And even further, if you look among people of African descent from various Caribbean islands, the variability is quite prominent, but it's lower than U.S. whites. So this kind of data should actually have triggered discussions more so than it has about social and environmental causes of hypertension. There's been nice work in the past. Nancy Krieger's one author who looked at the experience of racism and hypertension. And actually, it makes biological sense. But nonetheless, the idea of racial differences in hypertension being due to genetic difference is deeply entrenched in medicine and quite hard to dislodge at the moment. In fact, you have guidelines for treatment that categorize people into black and non-black and then call for different treatments for blacks than for so-called non-blacks, you know, which is just sort of everybody else in a mishmash.
Right. As we get toward the end of the conversation, I want to get into that kind of fundamental issue. There are genetic predispositions for disease. They are distributed in different ways around the world and in different communities. They don't match up, it sounds like, with the really simple categories we have for race: black, Asian, white, however we want to slice it up. Those categories that we use on a daily basis tell us very little about one individual compared to another.
Yeah, so, and this is key in the clinical context. So there's no question that there's tremendous human genetic variability across the world. What has not been fully engaged with is do racial categories capture that genetic variability? Can you demarcate genetic variability into these racial categories? Personally, I think the evidence is quite strong that you can't. And so then in the clinic, when you're faced with a patient and you and a patient that walks in, and you might make what we called in a paper a rapid racial assessment. You could be wrong. Your assessment might not, and oftentimes won't, match with an individual's self-identification. So I think the clinic is a context in which we have to think about the individual, ask questions about the individual to guide practice. That's different from using race. And so I think one point I want to make is I'm not making an argument for actually getting rid of race in all aspects of biomedicine and public health. We need race and to capture the experience of racism and to monitor health disparities. We also can use social definitions of race for research to understand how does racism actually affect health. Where the problem comes is when we use social definitions of race to study genetic differences.
And briefly, Lundy, for a doctor in a clinic, how do they avoid these pitfalls?
I think good histories is, and I've asked a lot of physicians about how can you not just act on this rapid racial assessment. And many are trying to do that by taking better histories, by talking to patients about what kinds of treatments they would prefer. And questioning of the guidelines and then thinking about the complexity of individual patients. This is not, in general, what's taught in medical school, although there are attempts at many medical schools to try to teach more nuanced ways of thinking about race. But to actually dislodge those social assumptions is going to take real work and real acknowledgement that we're making mistakes, we're misdiagnosing, and that we're actually contributing to a dialogue about difference.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Lundy Braun from Brown University. It's been 86 days since the Category 5 Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. The U.S. territory is in the middle of the largest blackout in American history, and conditions are still very poor on the island. Charles Venator Santiago is an associate professor with a joint appointment in political science and El Instituto Latina, Caribbean, and Latin American Studies Institute at the University of Connecticut. He's with us for an update on the latest news from Puerto Rico. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by asking, when we last talked to you, you were working to try to get your mother out of Puerto Rico. Can you talk about how she and your family are doing now?
Well, you know, we managed to get her. It was very expensive. The airlines were gouging us too much. But she came with a pneumonia and a heart condition and almost had a stroke. But as soon as she was here, we were able to get her great health care in Massachusetts, and she's doing well. Depressed, because she's here in the cold instead of in the warm weather with her projects, but safe and sound.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Is her story typical of other people in Puerto Rico, having a hard time getting health treatment and trying to figure out how to get it there or in the United States?
Yes, because in her case, her Medicare had not transferred over to the United States, so it took about a month to get it all set up. And lots of folks are leaving the island because they can't live under the conditions.
So can you talk about the conditions? We're still hearing about people not having fresh water, electricity. What is going on there now?
So part of the problem is that they're rebuilding the electric system. They're not fixing it. And before the hurricane, about a third of the electricity was consumed by corporations, and about 17% was lost to transmission. So we're talking about probably 35% of electricity is just not getting it to people. Right now, under current conditions, about 45% of the population has access to electricity, and water is not quite available either because they need to have electricity to purify the systems. And there's no way to measure who's getting what electricity at what point. So part of what's going on is that a lot of people are going on 100 days since Hurricane Irma, without electricity or water or drinking water. There's been an increase in deaths because of waterborne illnesses. And the local economy is destroyed because there's no functioning electricity in most of the island.
And I've heard there are other infrastructure problems, garbage disposal, soccer fields in some cases are temporarily being used to amass garbage because that system has kind of fallen apart.
There's no energy available to relocate garbage. Some garbage is just in the ground everywhere. Even tree removal is not available because there aren't enough trucks or there's not enough money to essentially clean up the streets.
We're talking to Charles Venator Santiago from the University of Connecticut, looking at the latest in Puerto Rico's recovery efforts. Can you talk about the response from the federal government? What are you seeing there?
So two things going on. One, it's been very slow, at a local and federal level. In part because in the case of FEMA, it's been overwhelmed with claims, not just with Puerto Rico, but also Texas and Florida and California. And it just doesn't have the resources to respond. Another reason is that they weren't prepared to essentially deal with the circumstances in Puerto Rico. They brought satellite phones that weren't adjusted to Puerto Rico. They brought English speakers instead of hiring local folks in the island who spoke Spanish. They assumed people could fill out applications through the Internet, even though 90% of the island did not have electricity. So there were a number of fumbles that were happening. But the major problem in the island, as the recent Senate debates revealed, was that the Puerto Rican government had refused to enact an emergency response plan that's been in place. So the federal response has been slow, inadequate, but also the local government has been inept, in some cases corrupt, in the implementation of a response to the devastation created by the hurricane.
Is part of the problem that, in some ways, Puerto Rico is in this unique position. It's part of the United States. It's not a state. It's kind of in this gray area. The U.S. can treat it one way or the other. The Puerto Rican government can treat it one way or the other.
Yes, because Puerto Rico is an unincorporated territory, there is no parity funding, and Congress can cherry pick, or the U.S. government can cherry pick, when it wants to treat it as a foreign country, as a part of the United States, or something else. So a lot of the responses to Puerto Rico are dependent on the mood of Congress and whether Congress sees it feasible to essentially subsidize responses to Puerto Rico.
And how much you mentioned the idea of rebuilding instead of repairing the electrical grid. How much of a debate is going on between, okay, we need quick fixes here to restore these services to people versus we need to build a new infrastructure that's going to be more resilient maybe for future disasters?
So part of the challenge is that the Stafford Act essentially calls for replacing damaged goods. But part of the problem is that Puerto Rico doesn't have the money, and the federal government has been slow in releasing money for materials. So they're essentially lifting up lines without investing in infrastructure. And the infrastructure had already began to collapse about 2 years ago, in large measure because it's outdated and because of the financial crisis. So there's very little talk about putting, say, underground electric lines or new purification systems or creating a multi-pronged grid in the island. Right now, they're just lifting up the lines and turning on the electricity and hoping that households will get access to electricity and water.
You talked about the financial situation in Puerto Rico. Can you talk about a little bit about the debt situation there, which was a problem pre-hurricanes here, and then how that's affecting recovery?
So part of the problem is that Congress in the summer of 2016 enacted legislation imposing a financial control board to manage the island's economy. And the financial control board decided to adopt an austerity approach that had failed in Kansas and in Greece. But that's the approach that they put forth to manage the economy. And by their own accounts, the economy would not grow until 2016. Now, this is before Hurricane Maria. On top of that, Congress refused to accept full faith and credit over the island's debt, even though it's now assuming control over the island's economy. So you had an economy that was not expected to grow before 2026. And then Hurricane Irma and Maria destroy the infrastructure, and Puerto Rico just doesn't have any income or money to repair anything. At the same time, the Trump administration is relying on loans for Puerto Rico to rebuild the island's economy and the infrastructure. But Puerto Rico just doesn't have the liquidity or the resources to fix anything.
And yeah, can you talk about what's left of the Puerto Rican economy now, already in rough shape? Now, as you say, the infrastructure damaged, destroyed in some cases. What's the economy like there now?
Well, you know, I was in the island about a month ago, and the most shocking, the most shocking thing for me was that I walked down some of the wealthiest and busiest areas in San Juan, and businesses were closed because they didn't have electricity, they didn't have access to internet, they couldn't function. So you have a sort of microeconomy that's just not functioning. Excuse me. Restaurants are closed, and people are just surviving on the retirement funds or some cases disability or in some cases vacation money. And without a local infrastructure, the island's economy is just stagnant.
Charles Venator Santiago is with us from the University of Connecticut. We're talking about the latest in hurricane recovery efforts in Puerto Rico. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences. Do you know someone who's still in Puerto Rico? Do you have family there or people who have moved from there to the mainland U.S.? Temporarily, permanently, we'll talk about that in a bit. How are they holding up, and what do you think the U.S. should do, could do, to help Puerto Rico? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Charles Venator Santiago is with us from the University of Connecticut. We're talking about Puerto Rico and how the American territory is recovering 86 days after Hurricane Maria. A lot still to do there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the U.S. should help or support its territory, Puerto Rico, right now, and the people there? What kinds of relief do you think should be sent to the territory? Do you think it's been treated with enough urgency by the federal government, by the media? And do you have a personal connection to what's going on there? If you're from there, if you have family there, if you've spent time there, call in with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Charles, we were talking about your mom earlier. She's come over to the country. Are a lot of people leaving the island coming over to the U.S. mainland since this has happened?
Yes, mainly or primarily to Florida, which is a special host state agreement with Puerto Rico and with the federal government. Excuse me. But they're also coming here to the United States and finding themselves without access to housing, work, or resources. And they're creating, in some ways, hardship in some of the families that they're or friends that they're coming to live with.
And you mentioned FEMA overwhelmed, not just in Puerto Rico, but elsewhere in the country. Is FEMA the agency that's supposed to help people as they temporarily take refuge in the mainland, or who's in charge there?
So, in the last, partly what's going on is that FEMA is paying for people to leave the island, or presumably paying, but the states assume responsibility for helping people. And some states just don't have the resources to help people. And by help people, I mean find them housing, temporary housing, jobs, transportation, education. States are doing something. New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. Florida is an exception because they're allocating the resources. But no, the states are expected to assume most of the responsibility at this point.
I want to bring on a caller now. Lee is with us in Green Bay. Lee, hi.
Hi, this is the first time I called, but I couldn't help but respond. What can we do as citizens to help the citizens of Puerto Rico? You know, I feel helpless, and I know it's a problem with the government, but is there something we can do as citizens to help this?
So there are several options. One is you can work directly with different nonprofit groups in the mainland and in the island, and I can forward you a list of reliable nonprofits that have been vetted by the City University of New York's Center for Puerto Rican Studies. And also tell Congress, listen, you need to assume responsibility over citizens and need to make some decisions about whether you're going to provide assistance to address the humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico.
Lee, thanks for that call, and we'll, Charles, offline get that list from you and get it posted on the Central Time Facebook page. I think we'll try to get that up there by the weekend. Thanks a lot for calling in, Lee. Are we seeing a big response from nonprofits, from charities around the mainland United States to this?
Yes, there's a lot. There have been millions of dollars raised from the diaspora, or the mainland, and steered to different communities. Some are successful, some have not been successful. But mostly what's been helpful is to send economic donations or equipment that can be used to purify water or to address issues. But you have to work with the local community so you don't overwhelm the community, and also to identify the needs of a particular community.
And we talked to a Wisconsin doctor who spent time working with people. I think he was actually caught while on vacation for the hurricane and ended up doing medical work down there. Are there enough healthcare providers doing that kind of work in Puerto Rico right now?
So according to the latest report from the Secretary of Health, almost about 96% of hospitals are up and running. Part of the problem is that people can't afford to go to the hospital right now because they don't have any money or to get private medical care. But most hospitals are already running. The problem is really getting access to medications and getting access to reliable energy to sustain or keep the hospitals working.
Charles Venator Santiago is with us. He's with the University of Connecticut, and we're talking about the latest news from Puerto Rico, recovery efforts more than 80 days after a major hurricane there. And Charles, getting back to people leaving the island, you mentioned a lot of them in Florida, some in other states. Is there a sense that they're leaving temporarily, or do you think a lot of people are trying to move to the mainland to stay now?
I think we won't know until February. The census is still measuring these movements. But anecdotally, in Connecticut, a lot of people are coming here and they're escaping the conditions in Puerto Rico. In other words, lack of electricity and water. But they're coming to the mainland, and in some places they don't have access to work or housing. So there's a lot of frustration, and a lot of folks are talking about returning. So at this point, I think it's reasonable to say that migration is temporary. But temporary may mean until next summer, until electricity is fully restored in the island. Particularly if you look at migrations based on parents who want to keep their children in schools. But we don't know, because the government of Puerto Rico had promised that 95% of the island would be electrified by now, and we're around 35% to 40%. And just people can't live under those conditions in the island. At the same time, they can't abandon their homes and their work in Puerto Rico. It's a catch-22 for a lot of folks.
Now, when we talked about this a little sooner after the event, some of our callers called in at 800-642-1234, by the way, called in and talked about the damage done to their homes. And, you know, it isn't just an economic story or a shelter story. It's, you know, these are their homes. This is an emotional story, too. This is traumatic for a lot of people there.
Yeah, and FEMA is committing to spend some money in fixing homes, but nowhere or nearly enough to repair houses. Last number I heard is they're committing around $17,000 per home. But, you know, excuse me, that's just not enough to repair the damage in some cases for some homes. For some homes, that means rebuilding a full house, and that amount of money is just not enough.
Now, getting back to U.S. federal policy, we've got the Republican tax bill, maybe an agreement on it among Republicans in Congress. It seems to be getting closer, and I understand that can have an impact actually on Puerto Rico and the recovery there.
So part of the problem is that the new tax bill, the Republican tax bill, is putting a series of tariffs or taxes on corporations doing business in Puerto Rico. And one of the tariffs is around 20%. For merchandise imported into the mainland from the island. That's going to devastate the local economy because folks just can't afford to pay that additional tariff, or the price of goods is just going to raise at an inordinate cost. Now, we don't know what's going to happen there, but so far Congress has indicated that they're going to continue to put that tariff. And some people argue that that tariff is going to be used to subsidize some of the recovery in the island. But at what cost? It might destroy the local economy.
That's back into that gray area of what Puerto Rico is and how it relates to the federal government. Because, I mean, that would if somebody said, hey, we're going to put a tariff on goods from Illinois being sold in Wisconsin, I mean, I think that's just plain illegal, yeah. Unconstitutional. But Puerto Rico, because of this unique situation, that is something that can be done.
Yeah, no, that's the exact analogy. But since 1901, the Supreme Court said that it is constitutional because Puerto Rico is what's called an unincorporated territory that belongs to the U.S. but is not a part of the United States unless Congress specifically says that it's a part of the United States for a particular part of the Constitution or legislation. On top of that, or in addition to that, the problem is that the Supreme Court and Congress have agreed that it can limit the extension of funds without extending parity funds. So you have a sudden uneven economic development based on access to funds. In other words, Congress can only send or is limited to sending cap funding to the island or block grants. That means that U.S. citizens who live in the island just don't have enough access to the same resources that are available to U.S. citizens here, Social Security, welfare, Medicaid, et cetera. So you have this sort of dual situation going on. It's treated like a foreign country for tax purposes and also for federal funding purposes.
So in our last couple minutes, I'm going to throw at you a question that people have been arguing about for literally decades. Would Puerto Rico be better off either as a state or as a completely independent entity, independent of the United States?
Independent of the United States, it would have access to international markets, and it would have access, and it could potentially have access to U.S. markets. So I think from a financial perspective, following the Irish model would work. Now, if Puerto Rico became a state, which is doubtful, because Puerto Ricans vote Democrats, and it's not clear that Congress is willing to give Puerto Rico two Democratic senators and four legislators, three or four legislators. But the argument there for statehood would be that it would have access to parity funding and constitutional equality. So in that sense, the additional revenues provided by statehood could sort of close the gap, not only for the fiscal crisis, but in general.
And Charles, as we wrap up, best case, what would your hopes be for the recovery over the next, say, 6 months in Puerto Rico?
So I think citizens should put pressure on Congress to approve a relief package that helps to light up the island and bring essential services to the island, like water and electricity and healthcare, or appropriate healthcare. But again, I'm really skeptical with this Congress. Congress is going the opposite way. They're trying to move money to the military as opposed to social services. But yeah, no, the idea would be that people would get access to basic living conditions to address the humanitarian crisis.
And then briefly, longer term?
Longer term, that there would be a rebuilding of the island's infrastructure that can withstand hurricanes and the devastation of, financial global markets or U.S. Investment. And by this, I mean we need to move to a sustainable energy system. We need to move to a more planned economy that can withstand the vagaries of the status. That would be the hopeful move. But that, according to the local government, the Fiscal Control Board, that has about anywhere from a $94 to a $300 billion price tag.
We'll leave it there for now. Charles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Anytime.
That's Charles Venator Santiago, associate professor. He has a joint appointment in political science and El Instituto Latina Caribbean and Latin American Studies Institute at the University of Connecticut. He joined us for an update with the latest news out of Puerto Rico.